Today on Rocking the Suburbs.
The Grateful Dead are the best effing American band. Stop.
Hi, everybody. It's Patrick Foster here. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this, the second set of our Rest in Power tribute to the late, great Bobby Weir, who passed in January. We recorded these episodes a few weeks back, and this is the first opportunity we've had to air them after our 2025 countdown. And I want to set up the second part here. You're going to hear me talking, which hopefully, as I said yesterday, I won't do too much of on these episodes, because we have three great Grateful Dead fans and Bob Weir fans in the form of Rob Gates, Kevin Bartlett, and Jason Goble. But you're going to hear me relating a little anecdote from my early days to try to pose a question about Bob Weir's guitar style and how he meshed with Jerry and other players that he worked with. So why don't we get the tape wound up, thread it up, and hit play on that bad boy. And here is set two of Rest in Power, Bob Weir. I'll tell you a very short anecdote that kind of leads into my next question. I remember when I was in, not in college, but I was hanging around with some people that were in college at the time at the University of Virginia. And at the time in the mid to late 80s, there was a lot of dead heads down there. And I was at a party with a bunch of people and they were just playing Grateful Dead live tapes. And I was just like, I don't know what this is. You know, I like punk music and stuff. And there was a guy there who I later became friends with. And he came over and he said to me, listen, here's what you got to do. Jerry's over here. OK, his guitar sounds like this. Now, listen. OK, can you pick out Jerry? And I was like, yeah, I think I got it. And he goes, all right, now Bob's over here. And Bobby, when I started listening, like in the state I was in, you know, I was able to concentrate. His guitar playing was, and I can't remember what era, you know, tape we were listening to, but he was lighter and livelier and almost, I don't know, jazzy in a way, right? I wondered from you guys, like, have, you know, seeing him live, and Rob, you know, you can probably speak to this. What was it about Bobby's playing that enabled him and Jerry to be, you know, so seamless like that? And maybe, you know, Jason, you're touching on it a little bit with he wanted other people, you know, to kind of be in the limelight. But I don't know. There was just something about the way he played, and especially during, you know, not like studio albums or studio songs, but especially during those improvisational moments, those stretch outs that, I don't know, he just seemed to have this, I don't want to call it humor, but there's a lightness and a spryness about his playing. Am I totally crazy here, Rob? Is there anything that you can pull from that?
Well, I that's an interesting observation, Patrick, because if you look at the interplay, especially off stage during interviews with Bobby and Jerry, there's a couple of Letterman clips out there on YouTube. That's exactly, you know, how they appear. You know, Bobby's sort of the foil for, you know, Jerry's straight man. Right. And I think it existed on stage like that too. I think, you know, they tried to, I think Bobby tried to challenge Jerry a bit, on stage. I think Jerry tried to challenge Bobby, and I think they were very good compliments of each other. I think, you know, Jerry one time called Bobby, I think he was like a, you know, like bat out of hell rhythm guitarist or something like that. You know, if you go through, you know, if you go into YouTube, there's some great isolated Bob Weir tracks on there.
Oh, really?
From both album and live performances. And they're just remarkable to listen to. It's like, what is this guy doing? Yeah. And I read this week, you know, he had those long fingers, those long Jimi Hendrix like fingers. So he was able to, you know, all over the fretboard where other people just couldn't reach. And I think Kevin was saying earlier this week, you know, he had the ability to, you know, play chords, you know, that nobody else could reach.
Right.
But I think there was a definite interplay between them. I think they challenged each other on stage. You know, and that just made the music better, especially, you know, when you're an improvisational band.
Very interesting, yeah. And Kevin, I read this week, too, as I was, you know, trying to read as many of the tributes as I could, that Bobby once said that he modeled his guitar playing after McCoy Tyner, the jazz pianist, which I found to be really interesting, and I didn't know that. How do you see that kind of influence?
I think we read the same. I think we read the same article. I've read, you know, a bunch, and I think that, you know, Trey Anastasio, you know, said some very kind words about Bobby and touched on his guitar playing and how. I mean, I don't think Trey Anastasio is a slouch on guitar. And a stretch of the imagination, and he, you know, is just raving about, you know, Bobby's ability. And the one thing about Bob, I didn't recognize this until later, is how humble he was. And I think it is this sense of bringing in other people and wanting them to shine. So, you know, he never considered himself a lead guitarist. You know, he said, I can't play lead, but I can play rhythm. And I think all of us here would disagree completely.
Yeah.
That statement,
yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, I'm not a guitarist. You are, Patrick. I don't know if he's finger picking or what he's doing. But it just, you know, I just know that when I hear it, I love it. It just, as Rob was saying, it blends. Sugar Magnolia, Blossom Bloomin', heads are left and I don't care. So much baby down by the river, you should have to come out soon for air. What a jam band is, right? I mean, the music just overlaps and blends and weaves and bops, and you don't know what's going to happen, and you start making a turn. And I think, you know, Bobby's, you know, rhythm guitar playing of you know, just weaving in with what Jerry's doing and kind of moving along to the next. I even saw it on a video today I was watching with Bob and Trey doing acoustic at the Wani Festival in 2017. And they covered Million Reasons by Lady Gaga.
Oh, wow.
Look it up. It's pretty damn good. So, but that interplay, right? Trey, you know, is watching for Bobby and Bobby's watching for Trey. I think that there's just something special with what Bobby had in being able to play with these multiple musicians and people wanted to play with him.
Well said. And I know what you guys are talking about. I've seen him playing live or watched him on video. I remember watching a Dead & Company, I think it was live stream. And Bob's like spanning five frets, you know, with his finger, which is not something most guitarists can do. You do have to have those long fingers, and you have the ability, and you got to want to play, you know, chords that cover five frets. There's that too. So Jason, you know, as someone who came in sort of, as you said, on the later end of the long, strange trip, how do you think Bobby's passing is going to affect that music now? Do you feel like there's anybody left that's going to carry the torch, or how do you?
It's funny because, well, first off, I just want to throw in, one of the things I watched, I think it was Monday, gave myself a day, but I ended up rewatching the other one on Netflix. Huh? It's a documentary, hour and a half documentary Bob Weir did. And, you know, he said in that doc about the McCoy Tyner thing that he basically wanted to be McCoy Tyner to Jerry Garcia's John Coltrane.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, it's funny. You watch that documentary, and one of the scenes in there is the National guys doing Cassidy with Bob Weir.
Right.
And I remember, like, it was a Friday night. I was in the office. The San Francisco Outside Lands Music Festival, their big music festival at Golden Gate, was on live stream. I put it on, like, just by chance, and the National had Bob Weir on stage to play the song Terrible Love. And I remember that sort of blew me away. Like, I'm like, okay, this is expanding. This is Bob just saying, I just want to play. I just want to, you know, see how my music matches or how my guitar matches with this music that generally is not associated with me. And that kind of, after I turned off the documentary, one of the things I was thinking of also was like the Farm Aid, where Weir and Wolf Brothers appeared like about 2 or 3 years ago. And you know, Bob brought up for the band Sturgill Simpson, Margo Price. I think there was a third country guy or girl involved in this. And I just kind of remember like, wow. He's brought like all these people into the fold, and you know, Sturgill Simpson came out like, and I hope he doesn't hate me for what I'm about to say. Sturgill Simpson came out like about a year ago, about like 6 months ago, or I think it was in the middle of whatever tour he was doing. And he said, I'm not a jam band at the end of the day. That hasn't been said. I saw a Sturgill Simpson show where he basically played for 3 hours straight with really no break. And maybe like said like 20 or 30 words to the audience. And it was just nonstop music. And I just remember walking out and saying to just random patron, like who we both had the same look on our face, like, holy S, I can't believe what I just witnessed. So where I'm saying is, you know, in addition to like the jam bands, you know, Fish obviously, and Goose. You know, there's a great quote from Goose, which maybe I get to later. But I have a feeling he's touched a lot of people that I think he's affected them that are not even in the jam band world. That I think he just had that effect because of he just loves playing. He loved playing, and he just wanted to keep playing.
Very interesting. So you kind of see the spirit already being, the seed already been sown, and it's going to be...
Yeah, and I would say not even necessarily the jam band world. I think there's a bunch of country artists who basically got sucked into the madness at the end of the day, for lack of a better word.
Very interesting. Rob, do you concur that the spirit and the seed is already out there? And well, of course, you know, Rob and I have gone to see Grateful Dead cover bands together. So there's obviously that, you know, instance of it, too. But I mean, do you see that it's already so pervasive that the spirit of that music and the Dead is going to be alive for a long time?
So I think one thing we discovered about Bobby, again, especially post Jerry, is that Bobby is a genius in many ways, you know, mostly surrounding the music, obviously. But I think if you look, and I thought about this morning, if you look at the selection of John Mayer for Dead & Company, and what that means for the future of the music, and how brilliant that choice was. And for, you know, three reasons. First of all, John Mayer came to the music. He likes the music. He was a fan of the music. He can play the music, and he's a damn good guitarist. And he's young, right? So, you know, Bobby could have picked Warren Haynes. Warren Haynes is great with the music. We've all heard him. You know, Jimmy Herring, same thing. But, you know, these guys are a little bit, you know, over the hill. Mayer is young. The other thing Mayer brings is cachet with labels, promoters, producers, right? He's got the name. He's got clout. You know, Warren Haynes goes and says, hey, we want to do a tour. It's like, yeah, okay, Warren, government cheese, so on, so forth. John Mayer comes and says, hey, I want to do a tour. You know, he's got people, you know, an audience, you know, baked in. He's got the clout in the industry. You know, and you can always say, well, I'll just do my own stuff. You know, they don't listen to Dead Company. And is he a great guitar player. But he didn't clone Jerry, right? He didn't try to be Jerry. He tried to be John Mayer doing Jerry's music.
Yeah.
And you look back on that now, and, you know, there's a solid leader of that band, if that band chooses to continue. I think musically, Jeff Chimenti's probably the leader of the band, and I definitely don't want to discount Billy and Mickey, you know, because obviously they were, but
of course,
you know, if we, you know, I mean, they're getting a little long in the tooth, as they say, but if you were going to extend the band and wanted to leave the band and the music overall in good hands, you know, I think John Mayer is a very strategic choice from both a business sense and a musical sense.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Kevin, where do you see it going?
Yeah, you know, I'm torn. I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of torn on that. I mean, I do agree that, look, the Grateful Dead music, it's going to live on forever, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the influence that they are, no matter what the Suburbs the rankings a few years ago of best American band, the Grateful Dead are the best effing American band. Stop. Don't even bring up any of your other Athens, Georgia people. So that being said, as I just alienated half our audience, you know, I will say I was a little reticent on going to Dead & Company. I really was, because, you know, I saw a number of Dead shows. I went to the Fairly Well shows in Chicago. And, but I will say, you know, when I went to my first one, John Mayer put it over the top for me.
Interesting.
He really did, you know, and then that was when Billy and Mickey were playing, you know, because Billy dropped out of it. And there's, I don't know what the story is with Bill and, you know, the, you know, well, Bill and Mickey, right? The drummer and the percussionist, the only remaining, you know, members. And, but John Mayer, I thought, did an absolutely fabulous job. And the other thing too, and I don't want to forget mentioning him, is O'Teal. When he didn't take the lead very often in singing, but when he did, man, I got goosebumps right now just thinking about that. And you know, and that had to have been a Bob decision, you know, as well. And I think, you know, here's the thing. There are so many other bands, and as Jason said, not just jam bands, but there are so many other bands who appreciate the Grateful Dead. You know, Day of the Dead, there was like, what, 70 different artists, you know,
that interpreted,
you know, Grateful Dead songs. And, you know, that's absolutely, you know, fabulous. And, you know, the music's going to live forever. Whether, you know, if John Mayer decides to load the truck up and they're going to go out and do stadium tours, I don't know. For me personally, I don't know if I want to be in a stadium. If they want to play a club and I can really, you know, get down with other people that enjoy the music, I'm there for it. But from a stadium perspective, that's where I'm like, I'm kind of out.
Said you had a good quote, but I think they're a good example, right, of somebody that's carrying on the spirit, but you know, is kind of a totally younger entity.
And I mean, to that end, you know, Goose, I think you would say, definitely has a different sound than Fish, and Fish definitely had a sound of Grateful Dead, but they sort of built on the same thing, and which is, you know, we're gonna play our style of music, but we're gonna, you know, we're gonna do it, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, Grateful Dead jam style. You know, I saw over the weekend, you know, it was the night before Weir passed, this band Eggy, and I was like, you know, this is, you know, they I'm like, these guys, I'm assuming at some point may end up being bigger because, again, they play with the same spirit. You know, I primarily went to the show because I had never seen Real Estate live and I wanted to see Real Estate. And, you know, Real Estate really is more of an indie band, but the fact they paired up with a jam band, you know, an interesting thing started happening a few years ago where, you know, I'm a regular reader of jambands.com. I probably have done it since I started getting into this music in like really seriously into this music in 2004, 2005. And jambands.com used to deal just with jam bands. Jambands.com ended up expanding to include indie bands. War on Drugs, who was on that Day of the Dead tribute. Regular discussion of War on Drugs and what they're doing. The National, you know, definitely not a jam band, but these guys, the Desners, were the ones who basically arranged for this Day of the Dead tribute. They produced it. It's a regular thing now when you go on jambands.com. It's not just jam bands. It's, you know, I say this to friends that, you know, I think we've adopted a bunch of your indie bands at the end of the day, because ultimately, you know, we kind of appreciate it. And, you know, I'll say that because I think that's something I get from Bob and, you know, additionally this music, which is, I don't know if I necessarily make, I was primarily a pop guy initially, like top 40, and then became a classic rock guy. It wasn't really until I started listening to the Dead and Fish that I'm like, really, I should be trying out these other bands. And so I know for me, like, I think this music kind of was responsible for expanding my palate at the end of the day. And that I'm also forever thankful for this music and for Bob.
Rose. In rainbows spiral around
And I just remember walking out and saying to just random patron, like, who we both had the same look on our face, like, holy S, I can't believe what I just witnessed.